Hello and welcome to 10 by 9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Dorn, and this is the 10 by 9 podcast. This week, 10 by 9 teamed up with the Belfast Photo Festival for stories on the theme, One Photo, One Story. I love this event, and it was a great success. So prepare for 3 wonderful stories.
It's a full and frank admission of youthful bigotry. One that when I told my late father-in-law one night over a few drinks, I thought he was going to excommunicate me from the family.
My mouth was dry and I was struck dumb from meeting my hero. I had no idea that this could happen to me because I'm never lost for words.
A Dave Allen-style comedy skit ensued with a coffin still held shoulder high was reversed from the graveside via the world's worst communal moonwalk.
So we've a teenage tearaway who learns his lesson, a star-struck fangirl who meets her idol, and a poignant day at a funeral with a few laughs thrown in. And while all the stories are standalone, I'll post the photos that go with them on social media. So let's kick off, and here's James Elson. It wasn't his first 10x9, but it was his first at the Black Box, which is a unique experience. There's maybe one or two little F-bombs in there, but nothing to get too worked up about.
I'm pretty embarrassed about this story, actually, as to why I've chosen to confess it in front of about 150, mostly strangers, apart from a few exceptions. In the Black Box, I really have no idea. I think Paul's power of persuasion comes to play with that. It's a full and frank admission of youthful bigotry. One that when I told my late father-in-law one night over a few drinks, I thought he was going to excommunicate me from the family. Just to warn you, I am going to admit to a crime, albeit a fairly minor one. I think the legal term is statute barred, since it happened so long ago. If any cops or other legal eagles are in the audience and disagree, then I shall just have to face the music in the cells of Musgrave Street Station. Let me take you back to 1981 and the 13-year-old me. I grew up in Rugby Avenue in the Holy Lands area near Queen's University. As many will recall, 1981 was a particularly terrible year in relation to the Troubles. The leader of the IRA in the Mayor's prison, Bobby Sands, had just died after 66 long days on hunger strike. Consequently, violence had risen dramatically, and you could taste the tension in the air, even in a religiously mixed area like the Holy Lands. I clearly remember the bin lids rattling in the nearby Omer Road as I was getting ready for school that beautiful late spring morning. This was a signal by the nationalist community in the area that Bobby Sands had died. There is no way I would describe the Holy Lands as an interface. Our street was far too leafy for that. But it was close to a strongly Republican and a strongly loyalist area and was by no means immune from the violence of the Troubles. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but when I was pretty fired up when I was 13 in many ways. Certainly in relation to the political situation in Northern Ireland, I was kind of obsessed. Bombs in the nearby city centre and Omer Road area regularly rattled our windows. In fact, we had crisscross patterns of sellotape on the window panes of our bedrooms to prevent any blast from shattering them. When the army or police came into the street, I always dashed out to say hello. And in truth, I found it all quite exciting. I think it's true to say we all feel immortal at that age. My dad was an OG, not an original gangster, an original gobshite, one of the very first members of the DUP. And as a young teen, I regularly attended the Reverend Ian Paisley's Martyrs Memorial Church on a Sunday. I guess you might call it these days radicalisation. As a result of all this rising tension, violence all around, and my youthful enthusiasm, some might call it fuckwittery, I decided I needed to strike a blow to defend our little piece of Ulster. Without veering into hyperbole too much, it really did seem like a doomsday situation in 1981. I felt we were lurching towards civil war, and I was ready to do my bit. The modern term for it is prepper, somebody who prepares for the worst. Nowadays, these people are usually obese Americans wearing MAGA hats and combat vests, storing food, guns and ammo in their underground bunkers, waiting for the second coming of Trump. However, for me, it was a case of nicking my dad's old motorbike helmet, stashing away a few spar bags full of bricks, and fashioning my own riot shield. Let me tell you about my shield. I wish I had a picture of it, I really don't. I had found a piece of plywood that was just about big enough to cover most of my body if I crouched down really low, centurion style. I had drilled some completely ineffective eye holes in it and secured the arm straps using an old leather belt, which I had nailed into the wood. I then decorated it with a rather large Ulster flag I had drawn myself. It wasn't so much a red hand of Ulster, more of a red club foot of Ulster, if I'm honest with you. I was never very good at art. Another potential problem was that I had painted it using white gloss paint. If there really was a doomsday situation, my shield would have gone up like a Roman candle in the event of a petrol bomb strike. I just hadn't thought it through. However, prepping wasn't enough. I felt the need to be proactive, to take action to show them-ins that us-ins would take a stand. So for several weeks in the summer of 1981, I stayed awake late into the night watching the street to ascertain when it became really quiet. Then one night, I decided it was time to strike. I reckon 4 a.m. was the optimum time. I thought I'd prepare quite well. I had already mixed some white paint, which I'd hidden behind the dog kennel in our backyard. I had donned dark trousers and a dark blue polo shirt so I could blend into the shadows of the night, like a shit milk tray man with acne. I quietly made my way down out of the rear of our house, down the back entry between Rugby Avenue and University Avenue, into Dudley Street. There, the huge brick wall of H&J Martin's Builders Yards was waiting for me. I picked some classic slogans for my first-time graffiti effort. No surrender, obviously, which I even spelt correctly, alongside for God and Ulster. Continuing the religious theme, God Save the Queen, and of course, FTP. I assume I don't need to explain what FTP stands for. At the time, the aforementioned Pope was John Paul II, Carol Wachtla. Hope I've pronounced that correctly. I recall he was a pretty decent guy who came to Ireland and everything. And in hindsight, I have absolutely no idea why anybody would want to do anything unspeakable like that to him. A bit like Brian and Monty Python's Life of Brian, I stood back and admired my handiwork. The union was safe. I then snuck back up the entry, patted our dog Stanley, there he is, on the head, and I crept into our yard so that he wouldn't bark. I then tidied the paint and brush away, carefully folded my clothing into the drawer from whence it came. I finally went to bed, mission accomplished. My bedroom door burst open at 7 a.m. My apoplectic mum screamed at me, "You wee shit, you've been painting slogans." I couldn't believe it. I had always suspected that my mum was psychic, but this proved it. She followed up with, "The police are downstairs and you're in serious trouble." I simply couldn't believe how she knew, and what was worse, that my beloved RUC were going to arrest me, a loyal son of Ulster. She left me to stew, and in fact, it turned out the police were not downstairs, and how she caught me on was that in my efforts to pacify Stan the dog, I had left a nice big splodge of white paint on his head. I still can't believe Stan is a tout. I was grounded for the rest of the summer and realised that I deserved it. My mum was so worried about me, and let's face it, she had every right to be given the dangerous times. I spent imprisonment listening to the transistor and learning the capitals of every country in the world. I can still give that a good rattle, by the way, all these years later. The thing that scares me when I'm telling this story is that the previous year, in August 1980, 16-year-old Michael McCartan had been shot dead by the RUC near the Omo Bridge whilst painting slogans. I didn't know Michael, but my mum was friendly with his mum. I can't believe I was so stupid. Well, actually, I can. I was just 13. I really don't think my one and only crime contributed to preserving the union. I know for a fact that the good folk at H&J Martin's painted over my slogans within a few hours. What a feckin' waste of time and effort that was. I'm not even sure anyone noticed it, to be honest with you. I've always believed that nobody should be ashamed of your past. Even if you're a reckless, bigoted wee bollocks like me, you are a product of your upbringing and your environment. You need to learn from your mistakes and grow, become a better version of yourself. I'm a different person now. I feel confident enough to talk about this, despite the embarrassment and possible legal consequences. If there's a moral to this story, it's that mums might not be psychic, but they're always right. And by the way, my shield was thrown out many years ago. It never saw action, thank feck. Perhaps if I still had it, I would mount it on the wall along with this picture of Stanley to remind me of who I used to be. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, James. That was great. Come again with more, please. And it won't surprise you to hear that James is a tour guide in Belfast who specialises in the history of terror. Quelle surprise. I've actually known James for almost 40 years from university days, and you know what? He's barely changed. And why not be like James and tell your first story at 10x9? We're always looking for new people, so if you've got a story you'd like to share, then get in touch at 10by9.com. I'll be more than happy to help. Okay, on to our next story. And she was the only woman at the 10by9 mic on the evening, and it was her first time. Here's Dolores Fisher.
Patti Smith has been an important figure in my life. She is my all-time favourite artist. I first heard her Horses album in 1975 as an impressionable young teenager. Her voice, attitude, mix of poetry and rock hooked me there and then, before I'd ever heard of punk. Punk music remains one of my favourite genres. Belfast has its own godfather of punk in Terry Hooley, but punk poet Patti Smith is truly the godmother of punk. I've seen Patti Smith perform many times in Ireland, England and France, and never been disappointed. Each new album and book are important moments. Patti gigs are among the few I would travel far to get to. My first and only tattoo, acquired just this year, features the letters P and S inside an abstract horse head. The tattoo design was done by my son, Aidan, and my daughter, Elspeth, and I each got it tattooed. A hastily arranged Patti Smith gig in Belfast's Elmwood Hall of 30th of July 2004 is probably my favourite gig of all time. It was a magical night, really personal and intimate, with around 150 people there. Patti, who loves visiting cemeteries, spoke of her earlier visit to Friars Bush Graveyard and asked the audience questions about it. She played songs from the Trampin' album released a few months earlier and ended with a prolonged version of Gloria. She came down off the stage and walked and sang right among us. Tonight I'm wearing the t-shirt I bought at a gig in Manchester in 2015 for the 40th anniversary tour of Horses, her first album. Patti's memoir Just Kids, published in 2010, focuses largely on her relationship with artist Robert Mapplethorpe in New York. A brilliant book, it depicts the poverty of New York in the 1970s and how it was a refuge and meeting place for artists. The book heavily influenced my family's holiday trip to New York in the summer of 2011. We plotted our own Patti pilgrimage, essentially, but that's possibly a story for another day. The power of Patti's lyrics was used at a moving event in Derry, Londonderry's Guildhall Square on the 27th of May, 2019. I was part of a pop-up choir organised by Katie Richardson to sing to welcome the arrival of a group of people that had completed Lyra's Walk from Belfast for recently murdered journalist Lyra McKee and for peace. Among the songs we rehearsed and sang was Patti Smith's People Have the Power. It was a very poignant and memorable experience. Finally, we reached the moment I met Patti Smith, as you can see from the photograph. They say you should never meet your heroes, but in this case, I'm so happy I did. I met and spoke with Patti Smith in 2019 in Charleville-Mézières in northeast France. This city may not be familiar to many, but it is the birthplace of the 19th century poet Arthur Rimbaud, whose work Patti admires and has written about. She has visited Charleville regularly and has bought and restored an old farmhouse there connected to Rimbaud's family, the place where in 1873, when his sisters were bringing in the harvest from the fields, the 19-year-old poet wrote his extraordinary prose poem, A Season in Hell. I spotted Paddy Smith on the 2019 programme of Charleville's annual Cabaret Vert Festival. The date coincided with my husband Johnny's birthday, and I proposed a birthday trip for 24th of August. You can see it was obviously my interest entirely. I set my heart on meeting Paddy Smith in Charleville to hand deliver a letter. I brought multiple copies with me, intending to get it to her one way or another. My letter was written on behalf of Girls Rock School Northern Ireland. It said how much we were inspired by her, outlined our work, and ended by inviting her to come perform again in Belfast. On the day of Paddy's performance in Charleville, we were eating the birthday lunch around the edge of the central Place Ducal, Central Square. I was confident that Paddy would have arrived in town the previous night and was keeping a hopeful eye out. But I couldn't believe it when I spotted Paddy and Lenny Kay, her longtime band guitarist and friend, strolling across the square from us, stopping by the fountain. The pair just stood out as different to the locals and tourists in the square. They both had long grey hair that caught and glinted in the sun. They walked with a cool gait, wore jackets and long trousers to our summer shorts. They just looked like the poet and musicians they were. I noticed how comfortable and relaxed they were in each other's company. After all, they were pals of almost 50 years, having teamed up for Paddy's very first performance in February 1971 in St. Mark's in the Bowery, New York. I leapt up and over to them with my letter in hand. I called Paddy's name. She stopped, turned and smiled at me and waited. My heart was rocketing. For the very first time in my life, I couldn't get a word out. My mouth was dry and I was struck dumb from meeting my hero. I had no idea that this could happen to me, because I'm never lost for words. It mustn't have lasted long, though, as she was still smiling. I told her my name and said I'd come over from Belfast to see her at Cabaret Vert. She thanked me for coming so far. She was very generous with her time and happy to speak. We spoke about the festival and Charleville. Then I plucked up the courage to tell her I'd actually written her a letter. I summarised its content, mentioning how moving it had been to sing People Have the Power in Derry. I said how inspiring I found her lyrics and that she spoke out on important issues. I handed her the letter and ended by hoping that she would return to perform in Belfast one day. I thanked her and said I looked forward to the gig that evening. I returned to the lunch table. I was simply fizzing with excitement. Johnny asked me, did I not want a photograph with her? I hadn't even thought of that. But of course I would love one. So back over we both went to speak with Paddy and Lenny again. I introduced Johnny, then explaining it was his birthday. Lenny wished him a happy birthday. Paddy graciously agreed to let Johnny photograph us. She added, though, that she didn't want to draw attention to herself. So afterwards, they waved us farewell and strolled on. Back at the lunch table, I could hardly eat the meal that had arrived. So thrilled was I to have spoken to Paddy. In person, she was all I could have hoped for. She had been warm, unassuming and friendly, generous with her time, and also interested in hearing how we had come to know Charleville. Perhaps this gets to the heart of the matter, for Paddy is really a fellow traveller. She's a person who shares her love of all that is special in the world and is not afraid to call out what threatens it. As if to underline the point, we kept bumping into her that afternoon in Charleville. After all, we too were fans of the spots connected with Rambo. First, we headed into an old church, only to find that Paddy, alone now, was the only other person there. We backed out to give her some space. Later, heading to the Rambo Museum, we saw her again mounting the entrance steps. So we sat in a nearby park for half an hour. We were mindful that she needed time to connect with people and places that she has valued her whole life. It is strange to reflect that, in fact, I would have had three separate opportunities in one day to hand my letter to Paddy in person. Of course, that evening, we were right at the front of the barrier, when she came on stage for another fantastic set. With one thing and another, I haven't seen Patty live since 2019. But tomorrow I'm going down to Dublin to see her perform at Vicar Street. I'm sure you can imagine how excited I feel. Plus, I had to go to some lengths to get the ticket. I had to write a feature on Patty. I had to now have to do a review of the gig just to get a ticket because I hadn't managed to buy one. But anyway, I'm sure it'll be worth it, and I hope I've earned my press pass. And just to add, she hasn't as yet responded to my letter, but I live in hope.
Well done, Dolores. Excellent. Patty's version of Because the Night is one of my favourite songs ever. Thank you. Unlike James before her, Dolores is also a tour guide in Belfast. It's like 10x9 is turning into a drop-in centre. Her tour is, again, there's no surprise here, the Punk History of Belfast tour. So, if you're visiting the city, check out DC Tours, or if you're a local and need something to distract a visitor for a couple of hours, pack them off to Dolores or James, or even our other regular contributor, Barney Gribben. Anyway, that's enough plugging for the tour guides. 10x9 is always free, but if you'd like to help support us, and I really would like to overhaul the website to make it more mobile friendly, then you can donate through Patreon. There's a link on our website. Many thanks to everyone who has given over the years, and also thanks to everyone who donates at our live events. And thanks too, of course, to those who come along and offer support in other ways. We really appreciate it. Okay, here's our third and final story on this podcast. He's a regular contributor and he's not a tour guide, but he would make an excellent one if he ever decided to do it. It's Paul Brady.
My brother, Mart, is a nurse and lived close to our parents. As they got older and ever more infirm, he would call every morning on his way to work to have a cup of tea and make sure they hadn't burned the place down or just old-fashioned murdered each other over the TV being too loud. On this particular morning, he was sitting and chatting while my ma complained about my dad not sticking to his diet as she put together his daily heart-healthy four types of bread, full mega fray. I could feel our Mart's eyes rolling as he told me. She put this fry on the plate that would choke a fucking donkey, he says. His tea, his cutlery, and then she dips into the fridge, cracks open a beer and set it on the tray too. A beer, I said, in a disbelieving tone. My dad was not a drinker, Christmas and family occasions. Yeah, he said. I said, dear, Mommy, it's 8 o'clock in the bloody morning. What's with the beer? You know your daddy, she said, took one of his notions and now he has to have a beer with his breakfast every day. I took the tray up to him, Mark continued, and said to him, here, fella, what's with the tin for breakfast? And he says, you ruined it on me. Up in my face, yelling about nobody telling him what to do under his own roof and all that nonsense. He was shaking my temper. I talked him into coming down to the hospital for a wee quick once over. I'm here with them both now. We couldn't have known then, but that was the very beginning of the end. He'd had a bleed in his brain. A starter for 10, as Bomber Gascoigne would say. He began a protracted period of misery with hospitals and an ironically named care home. His last year was exactly what he said he would never want. Incapacitated, watching the clock. No respite, no dignity, no release. After a horrific year there, he fell while unsupervised. Hit his head in the bedside cabinet on the way down. Grim as it was, we all agreed that it was his golden ticket. Because, thankfully, he never really recovered. After another 2 weeks of watching a stubborn owl engine, it was finally done. Big Joe, my dad, was a complicated man. He was brought up in a family steeped in the old school republicanism of the 1930s. Both his parents, and particularly his mother, done jail time, where she was tortured and left with mental scars that would never really heal. As a 5-year-old, he witnessed her blowing herself and a friend up in the kitchen of their house. It was him, the papers reported at the time, who raised the alarm by running into the street, screaming that his mother was dead. She wasn't. But I'm not really sure a 5-year-old ever recovers from that. It was probably the reason why none of us 7 children ever really were allowed to be political in any way at all. This extremely traumatic childhood had left him with a human compendium of complex contradictions. He was gregarious, likeable, hilariously quick-witted, and funny at will. He was also dogged his entire life by black moods and a trigger point temper. He was a great storyteller, a powerful singer, and someone who could turn his hand successfully to more or less anything. Simultaneously, though, he was plagued by self-doubt and a readiness to believe that he was somehow less. In his day, men kept quiet about their troubles. They didn't want to be a bother or a burden. They didn't want to be labelled as weak or unstable. In extremely rare, unguarded moments, he would share that in his chaotic childhood, he'd been raised mostly by his grandmother and had endured a pretty tough upbringing. He would then clam up and with some generalisation about how everybody had it tough in those days and how he was no exception. On Father's Day this year, my brother posted into our siblings chat group, "If you're feeling sentimental about Daddy today, just remember, if he was alive, he'd tell you to catch your cell phone." Our emojis all laughed. He was only ever remarkably candid once to me about the one time that he did go and ask for help. "I'm sitting there in the doctor's office," he says. "I'd been made redundant from a job in England and had to come home. I was finding it hard to settle and get work and had to sign on the brew for the first time in my life. I was feeling a wee bit low and wanted to see if I'd get some sort of tonic to give myself a shake. Next thing, the door opens and in comes this buck agent in a pinstripe suit with glistening patent shoes and pink socks and a matching pocket square. He sits down facing me. I look up. He's got this really bad wig on, sitting at an angle on his head like a cocked hat. It's like a rusty Brillo pad or a dead squirrel that somebody has nailed to his head. And his glasses are on a chain like the lady in the library. What seems to be the problem, young man?" he asked me. "You know what, Doc," I said. I was feeling a bit down the mouth, but I've realised that life could be a lot worse. I'll not take any more of your time up." I get up and get out of there. Like I'm going to tell Coco the clown here that I'm not in the best of form. I don't think so, big lad. The whole thing did cheer me up, though, put things in perspective and change my outlook. That also seemed to change my luck, too, as I was working again within a few weeks. It took us a while to get over there, over the mountain to Crumlin that day. It was early December, and a freezing wind was making the rain almost painful as it lashed into us. We had huddled like penguins at the back of the hearse as Big Joe was loaded up. And then we ran to our cars to get the heating on, and faces briefly thawed. Eventually, as the funeral procession slowly turned into the quiet little graveyard, we noticed there was some sort of commotion going on around the open plot. One of those scaled-down wee diggers was there, but instead of the diggery bucket thing on the front, it had one of those big pointy spiky things on it for breaking up hard ground. Obviously, I don't know what the technical terms are. A small collection of men in high-vis jackets were stood around looking into the hole and scratching their heads. My brothers and I, coughing aloft, began the slow approach to the graveside while an envoy was dispatched to see what the story was. It transpired that when they were trying to dig the grave, they'd come across a huge boulder that was too big to dig around or lift out, and any attempts to break it into smaller pieces had so far failed and nearly killed their wee digger, which they were really not pleased about at all. A Dave Allen-style comedy skit ensued where the coffin, still held shoulder high, was reversed from the graveside via the world's worst communal moonwalk. And after a three-point turn, the Joe fella was put in the back of the hearse to wait. There was talk of having to return to Belfast because some Jobsworth told us there was no way to open another grave at such short notice without the requisite paperwork, blah, 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 blah. Why is there always a sanctimonious prick in these situations? And then the crowds parted. One of the graveside dudes had decided that enough was enough, and he went to his truck for an old school solution. Sledgehammer in hand and mumbling something about paperwork my arse, he strode back through the shivering mourners and dropped with a whoomph into the grave. After three or four hefty whacks, there was a loud crack, and he started handing large pieces of the boulder up out of the hole. To this day, the larger pieces still lie under the hedge beside Big Joe's final resting place and give me a laugh whenever I'm there. My brother Mart grabbed some of the boulder shrapnel and gave us all a piece each. After nearly losing it once, I packed it away and now I just carry the photo instead. A memento of our freezing day in the mountains, when we all stood in the wind and rain, laughing loudly at our father's funeral. Laughing at the situation we found ourselves in, and also at the irony that on a different day, our deceased dad would have been leading jokes. He would have been there, regaling the other mourners, about the only time a man has ever been buried with a sledgehammer. Just as all of us sons had learned directly from him, he was able to walk that fine line between irreverence and respectfulness. Humour that was just dark enough to give people a release valve without turning into a Saturday night at the pier. We all know for a fact that he would have had the best crack at his own funeral, if only we hadn't just buried him at it, of course.
Thanks so much, Paul. As ever, a wonderful mix of the poignant and the flippin' hilarious. Thank you. And that's it for this podcast and for the summer. It and me are taking a wee break, but we'll be back in the autumn. 10 by 9 will be continuing, as always. Make sure to check out all the upcoming events on our website. That's 10by9.com. And be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and or Instagram. We won't flood your feed with nonsense, just information. Thanks to everyone who makes 10 by 9 happen. Leanne McConville, Margaret McClory, and this month, DJ Cara, who looked after the photos and sound on the night. Thanks too to the team at the Black Box, the best venue in Ireland, in my humble opinion. And thanks to the 10 by 9 audience, which as ever was so supportive and warm. And of course, thanks to all our storytellers. But the biggest thanks this week goes to James Elson, Denise Fisher, and Paul Brady. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.